Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Mark Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict predecided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, we thank you very much for your comments and your disclaimer that you've offered to us. Tonight we're going to have a little different twist to what we're normally doing. John is in actually Central America today and will be for the remaining of this week dealing with, of all people, the State Department of the United States. So that's what's going on there. I contacted Johnny Ringo, if you remember. He's been introduced several times. He filled in with for John a few weeks back. Johnny Ringo is was the lead investigator for the late Tony Davis, who I did the marketing for basically a decade until he passed away with a massive heart attack, so we're told. And the focus of Mr. Davis's efforts were, and including with, of course, Johnny Ringo as his investigator, was Title 18. So what we're going to do tonight, and I'll be working with John to alternate for the next basically 2 months about between Johnny Ringo 1 week and John the following week, is to share with you the Title 18 journey. From its foundations in fraud to where it has culminated in the incarceration of hundreds of thousands of people. And the saddest point of all of this is how profitable it is for the government by way of the budgets assigned to the Bureau of Prisons and so forth to incarcerate people. This is a lengthy, 6-8 hour course, if you would, to explain for your thorough understanding, which we court, of course, can't cover in the 30 or 40 minutes that our speakers converse with before we go into Q&A. So it's going to be alternating over the next, like I said, 6 or 8 weeks, and a chunk at a time will be delivered. Tonight the focus is going to be on giving you a skeletal outline of what we will be talking about or what Johnny Ringo will be talking about. And then we'll go from there tonight. If it's still a time available, maybe he'll delve into the first portion of it. I don't know. It just depends on how much time is available. And then we'll go into Q&A. Also joining us tonight is Tom from Eau Claire. You've heard Tom speaking several times with questions, as a student with questions. Tom was actually deeply associated with Tony Davis with regards to him being a student for Tony Davis and thereby having the benefit of the research that Johnny Ringo had brought to the table as well. So I expect that when we open up for Q&A that Tom will be participating in the lead there. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Johnny Ringo.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate the introduction.
Yeah.
First of all, I would like to express that this is Title 18, and it is expressly a federal statute. It has nothing to do with any of the states. It is totally and directly a federal statute that was enacted by the House of Representatives in 1947. And I'll get into the details shortly. But if a different bill passes the U.S. House of Representatives than the Senate, then the bill is void and no legal effect whatsoever becomes of it. First of all, until the Senate and the House pass the exact same bill and the bill is signed by the president, or the bill is not signed and becomes law without signatures because both houses passed the bill, there is no law. Just because the House of Representatives voted to pass a law does not make it an enforceable law without passage from the Senate as well. So all you had is a bill passed by the House in 1947 on Title 18, 80-772, and a different bill passed by the Senate in 1948. And then they have to get together and negotiate a combined compromise law for passage of both houses before it becomes law, or the law dies. This did not happen. There is total corruption in Washington at this time. I've got 542 pages to be exact, of complete documentation from individuals from the House of Representatives, attorney generals, a multitude of different people, and these all, I've made 9 trips to Washington, D.C. I've studied in the Library of Congress extensively, and I've researched every document I could possibly find and had help from several librarians there who were very, very helpful in this. This Title 18 is a real thorn in everybody's side. I have testified in several court cases, a multitude of court cases, and each and every time the judge or the magistrate, however you want to call him, has denied everything. He says because the law has got to be changed by Congress, which is definitely wrong. A court can change a law or statute. This Title 18 has been going on a little history. It passed the House in 1947. By only 47-6 votes. There was no quorum. You need a quorum in each house, which is a majority of the vote, in order to pass it and to be able to pass on to the Senate. The same thing happened in the Senate in 1948. Then both the Speaker and the head of the Senate took this unconstitutional law to the president, who was Truman at the time. And evidently he did not care or he did not know. I researched it. I went to Missouri and researched it in the library named after Truman in Missouri and found that the House and the Senate was not in session, which is a constitutional requirement of a law. Both houses have got to be in session when the president signs the bill into law. None of this ever materialize. And another short footnote is that it must be published in the Washington Journal for 6 weeks before it can become officially a legal statute. This never happened. None of this has ever happened with Title 18. Currently, there are 5,037 statutes in Title 18. They just keep adding and adding on, and it's not a legal law. As of 6 months ago, there has been over 7,673,536 individuals prosecuted under Title 18. This is a fiasco. But I'll be reading from my legal notes right from now on, and we'll settle for questions and answers after I finish. Petitioner takes judicial notice of the following as judicial notice in the Supreme Court, 93 Congress Rec 5049. There is no record of any quorum being present during the May 12, 1947 vote on H.R. 3190, bill in the House of Representatives. Verified letter from Jeff Trudeau, clerk, U.S. House, 6/28/2000, to myself. Dear Mr. Burnett, thank you for your letter requesting information on Title 18. In response to your inquiry, Congress was in session June 1st, 3rd, 4th, 7th to 12th, and 14th and 19th, 1948. However, Title 18 was not voted on at this time. Verified letter from Karen Haas, Clark, U.S. House, 8/30/2006. Yes, the Speaker of the House did sign Bill H.R. 3190 in the absence of a quorum. Verified letter from Karen Haas, Clerk U.S. 9/11/2006. After conducting a thorough examination of the journals, I found no entry in the Journal of the House of any May 12, 1947 vote on H.R. 3190. The Senate took no action on this H.R. 3190 bill to the December 1947 signed then adjournment. Page 50 of the Congressional Report, 80th Congress, first session, indicates 44 members, which is not a quorum. There was over 416 members in the House at that time. Congress first session indicates only 44 members voted, 38-6, to amend H.R. 3190 on May 12, 1947. Therefore, by counting the total yes and nay votes, a quorum was not present. According to House rules, when less than a majority of a quorum votes to pass a bill, the journal must show the names of the members present but not voting. I found no such record of any names for the May 12, 1947 vote. Verified letter from Nancy Erickson, Secretary of State. Thank you for your recent letter requesting information on the status of H.R. 3190 from the 80th Congress. I asked the Senate Historian's Office to review the correspondence you endorsed, and they were only able to verify that no action was taken by the Senate on H.R. 3190 prior to December 19, 1947. Verified letter from Lauren Clark, dated August 20th, 2010. Thank you for contacting the Office of the Clerk. Our office has conducted research of the House Journal and Congressional Records in regards to H.R. 3190 and the voice vote that was taken on May 12, 1947. After researching these official proceedings of the U.S. House of Representatives, we have been unable to find the names of the 44 members who responded to the voice vote. This letter is in the Clerk's Library and the Library of Congress. Independently verified. This was a man who was wrongly accused under Title 18 and who spent the last part of his life fighting this. His name was Harry Lapham. Independently verified. Memorandum, Harley Lapham from Harley Lap G. Lapham from on Monday, July 27th, 2009, 3:17 p.m., logo from the U.S. Department of Justice. Attention to all department's heads. There has been a large volume of inmate requests for administrative remedies questioning the validity of the Bureau's authority to hold or classify them under 18 U.S.C. on the claim that Public Law 80-772 was never passed or signed in the presence of a quorum or a majority of both houses of Congress, as required by Article 1 and 5, Clause 1 of the Constitution. Although most courts thus far, relief on Field v. Clark, 143 U.S. 649, 1892, to avoid ruling on the merits of these claims. However, there has been some of which who have stated that they were not bound by the Field case. That's the court's claiming. But these cases did not involve any quorum clause challenge. So out of the abundance of caution, I contacted the Office of Legal Counsel, the National Archives, and the Clerk of the House of Representatives, that there is no record of any quorum being present during May 12, 1947, both on Bill 3190, Bill of the House, and the record is not clear as to whether there was any state Senate vote on H.R. 3190 during any session of the 80th Congress. There's only Supreme Court case that says in order for any bill to be valid, the journals of both houses must show that it was passed in the presence of a quorum. The word quorum comes up continually in all of these letters, which states that there was no quorum. This law is a totally fictitious imagination of the United States government. The Clerk of the House states that on May 12, 1947 vote was a voice vote. The Parliamentarian of the House states that a voice vote is only valid when the journal shows that a quorum is present, and it's unlawful for the Speaker of the House to sign any enrolled bill in the absence of a quorum. On May 12, 1947, a presence of 218 members in the Hall of the House was required to be entered into the journal in order for the 44-member 38-6 voice vote to be legal. It was not. It appears that the 1909 version of the Federal Criminal Code has never been repealed. Therefore, in essence, our only true authority is derived from the 1948 predecessor bill to Public Law 8772. Any law that was passed before another law holds precedent over that law being discussed. Although adjudication of the constitutionally of congressional enactments has generally been thought to be beyond the jurisdiction of federal administration agencies, this rule is not mandatory. According to the Supreme Court in the case of Thunder Basin Coal versus Reich, 510 U.S. 200-215-1994. Therefore, the Bureau, under advice of the legal counsel, feels that it is in the best interest of the courts to continue addressing all of these administration remedies. Requests by stating that only Congress or courts can repeal or declare a federal statute unconstitutional. This has not happened because I personally have presented total documentation to several courts of the process that has got to be followed for in order for a bill to become a legal statute. Each and every judge totally sidesteps this because they are afraid of repercussions. As it states, only the Congress or courts can repeal or declare a federal statute unconstitutional. Yet they are terrified to do so for the simple fact that by prosecuting individuals under this law, of which there have been millions, they are profiting immensely by incarcerating individuals. And it is my understanding that in order to be guilty of something, you have got to break a law, a legal statute or law. This law has never passed, has never legally become a legal statute, and yet they are prosecuting and sending innocent people to prison over this. There was an investigation in 1964. It was the seventh edition of the United States Code was prepared and published pursuant to Section 3033C of Title I of the Code. It constitutes a consolidation and codification of all general and permanent laws of the United States in force on or by January 8, 1968. By statutory authority, this edition may be cited as USC 1984-ED. Previous editions were published in 1926, 34, 40, 46, 62, and 58. Inasmuch as many of the general and permanent laws which are required to be incorporated in this court are inconsistent, redundant, and obsolete. The Commodities on the Judiciary is engaged in a comprehensive project of serving and enacting the code into law, title by title. In forbearance, this plan bills have been enacted to review quotability and essence of laws and qualities of Title 2, 3, 4, 6, 9, 14, 17, 23, 28, 32, 38, 37, and 39. As you might have noticed, Title 18 was never codified or recognized by the people that instituted this United States Code. There was questions as to why it was omitted, and when the research was done, it was found out that there were very large discrepancies. Thus, they did not codify the law. Because it was not codified, no citizen that's under title section 4001, no citizen shall be imprisoned or otherwise detained by the United States except pursuit of an act of Congress which enacts the law. This has never happened. The law was never passed, and yet United States are codified, which is a constitutional requirement, and listed as a legal statute. It has never happened. And thus, people are still being incarcerated under this illegal statute. Here's a letter from Karen L. Haas, clerk of the U.S. House of Representatives. After conducting a thorough examination of the journals, I find no entry in the journal of the House of any May 12, 1947 vote on H.R. 31 bill, although pages 343 and 344 of the Journal of the House of Representatives in the first session of the 80th Congress indicates that the bill was amended, which means it was discussed but never voted on. And thus it was transmitted to the Senate for concurrence. The Senate took no action on Bill H.R. 3190 prior to December 19, 1947. Page 5049 of the Congressional Record, 80th Congress, first session, indicates 44 members voted, 36-6, to amend the bill, but was never voted on to be passed. Therefore, by counting the total yes and nay votes, a quorum was not present. There again, the quorum comes apart. According to House rules, when less than a majority of a quorum votes to pass a bill, the journal must show the names of the members present. But I found no record of any names on the May 12, 1947 vote. I hope this information has answered your questions. Sincerely yours, Karen L. Haas, Clerk, United States House of Representatives. I could go on and on. I've got a multitude of letters from the various attorneys representing the United States, and they all sidetrack the fact that the bill was never passed. They just assume, and thus they prosecute individuals on this bill. And a footnote is that the attorneys, the federal attorneys, representatives representing the individuals, the plaintiffs, are all sworn officers of the federal court. And I've been involved in several cases, and I find that they have a tendency to back down whenever they are challenged. They will not stand up for the person's constitutional rights. And when these letters and documentation, certified documentations, have been presented to the courts, the court totally dismisses it without actually acknowledging anything. And this has been a very large hang-up. I've been at this for 23 years. And like I stated before, I've got over 540 certified copies from various members of the House of Representatives, this Karen Haas, Jeff Trudeau, several attorney generals, and they just refuse to acknowledge that Title 18 does not exist. I've banged my head against the wall many times, and I addressed it to the courts. The courts, and I presented the documentation several times, all the time. And he just totally refused to acknowledge it. In the future, as Michael has made reference to, I will be reading documents from individuals from 1999 to 2018, all from the Library of Congress and the Library of Congress, And they all verify exactly the same thing. It's like a broken record, the documents coming through, but they all keep referring that only the courts or Congress can change a law. Well, I've met with several individuals. There was a congressman from New York whose family member was involved in a federal court case. And I was requested to testify at his trial, and then I was also requested and had a sit down with 38 senators and representatives in Washington a year and a half ago. I presented these documentations to them, and they all agreed that something has got to be done or should be done. As of today, I have not received any correspondence from any of them. About a year ago, the federal court system issued a note that the local district attorneys should not be using Title 18 as a statute to prosecute people under. But evidently that memorandum has went awry because people are still being prosecuted under Title 18. I'm presently working on two cases right now, it just came to light within a few weeks. So that memorandum was totally discontinued or dismembered or totally ignored. And like I say, I've been at this for 23 years, and it has become a very frustrating and head-banging situation. That at this point I can only present the facts, and the courts refuse to accept it. So, but that's about all I've got for tonight, Michael.
All righty. Well, it's a great skeletal setup for what we have, and of course over the following weeks. Johnny Ringo will be going into depth as he parses out each portion.
Into detail.
Let's start with the questions. Press star 2 on your keypad. I'd want to bring up first, where is he? There we go. I want to bring up first Tom just to share possible antidotes with Johnny Ringo and others here, and then we'll move to Michael and Anna Marie and Jennifer Sue. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. Thank you, Johnny. Appreciate your effort. I was incarcerated for 4 years, mail fraud, and working with a lot of people to, at the time, to try to negate it. And Michael has helped me and things lead me to different people. But the bottom line is, when I was incarcerated, I'm going to say I had the privilege. It was the honor and the privilege being in the same hotel situation as numerous very influential people. And one was a congressman, one was a senator, and one was, and I do say this in the very utmost respect for the gentleman, he was one of the mob's biggest attorneys. And after we all got to know each other and realized that we're all on the same boat and all this and everything, Title 18 came up very well. And I had been introduced to Title 18 through Robert Fox, and then a gentleman's pen name was Screwy Louie. I'm just throwing these out to see if you know some of them. And then I had a gentleman banker down in Kansas City write a beautiful jurisdictional thing for me. But anyway, everything was doing well. And good old Tony Davis, loved him dearly. He was an excellent friend, tried to help. Well, everything in my life was fair until he helped me write a 22-page memorandum of law explaining exactly in bullet points of what you were explaining tonight. And that was fair. Sending in, life wasn't too bad. But when he sent me in the certified copy of the memorandum that Mr. Lappin sent out to all the prisons, boy, I'll tell you, I didn't know if I was going to make it out of there or not. And I was a little bit excited. So I wrote to a couple senators on the outside and told them, I says, now I'm being denied my privilege. I'm being put in solitary confinement. I cannot go to the law library. If I'm lucky to make it, you got like maybe, 50 minutes someplace. So by the time you walk across the campus and you get in there, you got maybe 15 minutes to work, Well, they would not sell me any typewriter tape. You had to buy your own typewriter tape and everything. And it was quite a hassle. So anyway, I stuck my head out, got a letter from a very prominent senator, and he says, we will make sure that you have the proper tools and things to defend yourself, and we will help you get the answers. Well, this is so unique because just in the last week, I have made contact with this senator, and he says, what's ever happened to your situation? He says, I remember you writing to me, and I wrote you a letter stating that you will be given your rights and so on and so forth to pursue your case. And I said, sir, I said, all hell broke loose. I said, I didn't know if I was going to have food. I didn't know if I was going to come out with all my body parts. I didn't know what was going on. And he says, well, he says, after these elections, he says, I think it's time we relook at this again. So I was very, very excited and everything. And then some of the people that were incarcerated with me, when they got out, we find out that they mysteriously died or they were hit by a cement truck on the expressway. I don't know too many people that are walking on the expressway in Cleveland, Ohio, that would get hit with a cement truck, and so on and so forth. So this is to the point now. It's beyond interesting because, like I said, these people, they mail fraud, and we are maybe now realizing that I might have been a fall for some of these government actors that might have been using me to use my name and accounts and things to do some activity. But anyway, I'm to the point now where every night I just say, hey, Lord, I thank you that we came through. It's not fair to my family. My wife and my kids and everything have been traumatized. They've been chased by the three-letter people. It's been just phenomenally, unbelievably. But we're there, and I just want to thank all you guys for your time and effort. And to all the newbies on these calls, and to me, a newbie is anybody that's 10 years or younger with your remedies in the law, you people are blessed. You're beyond blessed to have this information and the experience of people like Mr. Ringo and I and so on and so forth. So I have a lot of information, could share a lot with you. Don't want to mention a lot of names on the phone. Like I said, I think I still have a certified copy of Lappin's report here, but it's just interesting. And we are now working trying to bring some of this to light again, and we would like to share with you my jurisdictional paper that's in the courts. And like you said, I was hot. I was hot on him. The judge says, I'm not going to have you come into my courtroom, Mr. Anderson, and make a fool out of me. And I said, sir, I never called him Your Honor. I just said, sir, you're right. You don't need my help. You're doing it all yourself. Don't need my help. And I'll tell you, it took him about 30 seconds to run down the hall and get a public pretender and put me under their disguise, you know?
Yeah. I think, Tom, it would be really good if we could get a conference call with John, Johnny Ringo here, yourself, and that senator on a conference call.
We can do that. It's definitely doable. So I just want to thank you.
Is he currently a sitting congressman still?
Yes, very much so.
Okay, good. All right. Good deal.
Very much so. And I just want to give the utmost respect to Tony. I could get him so wound up, and then he would get in a hurry. And you'll see what I have, Johnny. You know it's his typing because the way he spells words and misses things, that was Tony Davis style. You can tell it's his original, you know?
Yeah, I associated with Mr. Davis for about 6 years. Matter of fact, he contacted me one time, and I was very much puzzled as how he got my name or references. And after a couple of years, we got to be very good friends, and
yeah.
I considered him a true and dear friend. But as you have mentioned, that there's individuals that mysteriously demised.
Yeah.
I have documentations of three individuals that the same process happened to. And they were working very closely with me. And one was a judge. And I inherited his total legal library. And he was a very close and dear friend. And I've got several affidavits from him, and which I will read in the future dates.
Sure.
But this evidently is a very, very touchy subject with the federal government. And if people get too close, they kind of disappear.
Yeah. This is what happened. And this one gentleman that I was housing with, when he got out, he was had it all set up. He was going to go and meet with Greta and figure out how to get some of this information out to the public and so on and so forth. And 2 weeks after he was released, he mysteriously was no longer with us.
Demise, yep.
So we just thank you very kindly.
All right. Thank you, Tom. I was next is Michael. Go ahead, Michael, from Las Vegas.
Yes, I caught most of it. I'm on the road right now, but I stopped to get gas so I could listen to it. Anyway, it's my understanding, and I don't think I'm wrong, that all federal code, the law, legislated law, has to be recorded and annotated in the Federal Register. Now, they have other stuff in the Federal Register, but it doesn't meet the criteria for it. It just, they try to put it in there to confuse people. But if it's a legislated law, by law, it's supposed to be in the Federal Register. And the other thing is when they run down to get you or they try to appoint you a public defender because they can't do it if you refuse it, they want to do that because I've got an iron worker working on this right now that he's checking to see if it takes three signatures to convict you, put you in jail. So if that's their law, that's why they want to get you a public defender, because his signature is going to put you in jail. You can't put yourself in jail if you refuse to answer questions. That's unconstitutional for them to force you to answer a question. You plead the fifth, as Bill Clinton so famously did.
He was notorious for that.
Yeah, the definition of is.
Anything else, Michael?
That's it. When I get a confirmation on this about the lawyers having three signatures to put you in jail, I'll get all the pertinent information and I'll get it to you.
Okay. Tom, you coming back with a question or a comment?
I have a comment. I'd like to speak to that gentleman about what he asked. I researched this quite extensively, and the three signatures are to inactivate our bond for our straw man.
Well, that's because all those secretaries in that federal courthouse are working on the financial aspect, which goes before the judge, because he's not looking. He has the financial contract in front of him so they can take the money off of it, and then they're going to take you and either fine you or put you in jail, which is going to cost you more money. And it's total corruption is all. They beat the mob at every point.
We understand that, but I settled. I credited and I debited my accounts in the courts. And every time they had three signatures against my one, it was overruled. So there's something about those three signatures, definitely for the bond. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you so very much, Tom, and thank you so very much, Michael. And next is Anna Marie. Go ahead, Anna Marie.
Good evening, everyone. Please excuse me. I have laryngitis. I'll try to talk as loud as I can. Thank you, Johnny. And Tom, being such warriors. Mom, my question is, with the state of affairs, the way everything is with the laws right now, I mean, look what they even did to President Trump. What at this point can we be doing to be making changes without getting run over by a truck?
That's one hell of a good question. In my estimation, this country is in total turmoil. I mean, what they're doing to President Trump, they've been after him since before he was even president, and they continue it. They're beating a dead dog. Let bygones be bygones, in my estimation. Of what can be done about it, I don't know. I've been in court over this Title 18, to be exact, 63 different cases. I've testified in front of the Supreme Court twice on this. And what they came up with is that the statute does not apply to the infraction. Now, you can figure that out because I can't. Title 18 has got 5,037 articles in it. I spent one winter in Wisconsin here, which are very long, and I only got through about half of these articles. I don't consider myself an imbecile, but it was very, very hard to understand the legal jargon that was going on. And what can be done with it at this time, I have no idea. I wish I had the answer for you. I really do.
Okay, anything else, Anna Marie?
Well, I think maybe the more people that are standing together and are knowledgeable, at some point we can brainstorm and come up with something.
One of us needs to own a television station like ABC News that, you know, have the whole world that are as a bully pulpit to work from, and then just do a live call and share it with the world. That's about the only thing that you can do all at once so that they can't pull it off. All right. Next is Miss Jennifer, then followed by Kent. Go ahead, Kent.
Go ahead, Jennifer or Kent?
I mean, Jennifer, I'm sorry.
Unfortunately, I missed the first 15 minutes. And is Title 18 the one that is used to do government, local government officials for if they don't like file your deed for record and charge send you a bill back?
No. It's these are federal crimes, which logically would have no force and effect in a state, because a state is one government / country, and the United States is another government / country. So they should have no commingling. Yet that's what they do all the time. Thank you.
Okay, what was the title to the people, local government officials?
Well, you have deprivation of rights under color of law. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I guess. What title number is that, or isn't it a title number?
Title 42, Section 1983, 1985, 1986. It's also Title 42, Section 9, Title, oh, I forget. One of them is civil complaint, and the other is a criminal complaint regarding deprivation of rights.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
All right. Title 18, Section 242. Title 18, Section 242 is the criminal face of deprivation of rights under color of law.
I thought it was Title 18. Okay.
It is.
Okay. Is that a different Title 18?
No. Same Title 18.
So it actually doesn't actually exist?
No.
Okay.
But they act as though it does.
So can we act as if it does when we sue them?
Yes. Yeah, but it takes a prosecutor to file criminal charges. Regular folk cannot file criminal charges.
Uh-huh.
They can file criminal complaints, but they can't file criminal charges.
Uh-huh. Okay. I have a million questions, but I'll just keep going with someone else. Thank you.
All right, we'll just hit star two again when you come up with something. Next is Kent. Go ahead, Kent.
Good evening. Thank you for what you do, Johnny. It's well appreciated by many people. I have several questions I want to ask. Is it possible that this continues on, as you're saying, unchecked, because we know that they've set up a secondary system of government and these types of issues come up all the time with oaths of office, why they don't have them, do they really need them, et cetera. They're just doing in their system what they do, and they're not really abiding by the Constitution. Is that a good part of this problem?
You summarized it pretty much in a nutshell. Title 18 does not exist. It never has. And yet they continue to prosecute people underneath it for their own benefits. They totally disregard any documentation that verifies that this statute does not exist, but they keep adding articles to Title 18. As I stated, there's over 5,000 articles in Title 18. And to understand each and every one of these articles is beyond my comprehension. I had a judge that was a friend, a very close friend, and he could not understand it. And he was a judge for over 40 years. So I do believe all they want to do is confuse, keep adding and adding into the confusion so that people just kind of throw up their hands and say, what's the use of it? I can't win. I refuse to do that. I'll go to my grave fighting this particular case. And when I pass, I will pass it on to somebody who I hope will continue to fight. But as my recollection is that the federal government is just trying to totally confuse everybody under this statute without actually having to face the music. That's my estimation of it, my opinion.
So what we're saying is that as there is enough evidence to prove today that government is not there to serve the people, it's there to be self-serving. That's basically the same thing with Title 18. It's self-serving to those that masquerade as government today.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, what is to why couldn't they just today? You were alluding to the fact that conversations had been underway with congressmen or senators, et cetera, with the courts. Why couldn't they just today take all of these numerous sections that are under Title 18 and pass the whole thing just as one operation? Is it possible that they could somehow do that?
Well, there is a law that was it was the repeal of prohibition. It happened in 1930. And at the tail end of that law, it stated that each and every statute passed by the federal government must be in sequence. That means 1, 2, 3, 4. This particular Title 18 was supposedly passed in 1948. So they would have to go back from 1948, if they repeal it or disregard it, they would have to go back to 1948 and subsequently each and every statute that was passed into law since 1948 would have to be renegotiated. It would be one hellacious mess.
All right, so why couldn't they then today, and maybe they could, why couldn't they pass statutes that resemble these or duplicate these one by one and just go ahead and pass them today? Because isn't it correct that when statutes are passed, there's another group of lawyers, I forget what they're called, it escapes me right now, that decide how the statutes get written, whether they're positive law or not positive law, dispositive law, and what title they go into. So why couldn't it be manipulated that way to put all of these things, you know, back into place?
That's a possibility. I've never experienced any such thing. You got to remember, we're dealing with the federal government. They are more corrupt than any mafia organization ever existed. For the simple reason, it's all for financial gain for everyone. There is a federal judge down in Milwaukee who is driving a Bugatti. And these cars don't come cheap. There's only 8 of them in the United States. So he's getting, it's documented. He gets a kickback on every federal case he gets. So these federal employees, shall we call them, are doing anything possible they can to fill their own pockets with total disregard for the populace.
Mm-hmm. Now, not to take anything away from anything that you're saying and all the research you've done, but in answer to Raven's question about what can be done about this, isn't the position of correcting one's status to an American national basically the answer to this problem? I mean, it doesn't excuse anything they've done, but isn't it the answer?
I don't know. I do not. That is not my field of expertise. You would have to talk to Michael about it, which is his field.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your responses. I appreciate that. And I have one question for Tom. Could he go into a little more detail about what Michael was talking about when he mentioned that he had credited and debited his own accounts? I'd like to hear a little more about that if I could, please.
Yeah, I've got Tom open here, but I'd like to save that for a separate call. It's bringing up something that is not germane to this call tonight.
Okay.
But I do want to have that. I do want to have that addressed, and we'll talk about that some other time. Is that all right?
Okay, Mike.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. Next is Anna Marie is back, along followed by Ed out of Beaver Falls. Go ahead.
Just some food for thought. Michael, you had mentioned maybe more of it being publicized on a large scale. Food for thought, how about maybe bringing it to Marjorie Taylor Greene? She seems to be like an open, you know, an open purpose person for law, or like Scott McKay, who does has
do you have their private numbers?
I could do research.
Please do. I know that you're good at that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. I just had my machine go blank on me. Ed is next. Did I unmute you in time, Ed, or is it you muted still? All right. Just everybody give me a second. The machine's rebooting. Here we go. All right. Go ahead, Ed.
All right. I am curious as to the process of encodification. I thought they would, my understanding was that they pass a statute and that becomes added to the statutes at large. And then they take each individual statute, and for like Title 18, they would codify the criminal parts of a statute into Title 18. Now, if Title 18 is bogus, like I think you've proven that pretty much. I was in prison, and that was a big deal. I was in there in 2011. And that was still a big deal then. And a bunch of people were asking me about it because I was fresh off the street, la-di-da. But I didn't know anything about it then. So anyways, wouldn't they be able to cite to the statute at large for the crime that's been committed?
My answer to that is that Title 18 has never been codified.
Sure. Understood.
And so that is their way of sidestepping everything. All of the other statutes, as I've written, there's several of them, have been codified. It's put in a book and says, okay, this is a legal statute. Title 18 has never been codified. And under that, if a person is prosecuted under a statute that has not been codified, they cannot be incarcerated by law.
Yeah, understood there, too.
So it's, like I say, there's the government has maintained a lot of loopholes on this Title 18.
On everything they do.
So, and...
everything they do now.
I wish I had the answer for it on how to correct this, but like I say, I've been at this for over 20 years, and I have not come up with it yet. But I need all the help from anybody out there.
Yeah. Kent addressed as a possibility is correcting your status, an answer to that. And the answer is yes, because if something is codified, the Code of Federal Regulations do not apply to an American national. Simple as that. So the we've got the tool, but the key to it is to educate the judiciary, to educate the players in any litigation as to what that's about. And that is something that's being worked on right now. Okay. Anything else, Ed?
Yeah. He mentioned another thing. I didn't quite catch how he introduced the statement, but it used to be in the criminal code and in the venue part of the code, and it made it pretty easy to see that U.S. statutes are for property owned and people living on U.S. territory, U.S. land, where the jurisdiction is solely the U.S.'s. Where is the citation for that, or what version of the criminal code was that? I think they took it out in the 90s. I'm not 100% sure, though.
I have no knowledge of that.
Okay. I thought the criminal code was part of Title 18.
Basically, it is.
Well, I mean the judicial code.
Okay. I don't have an answer for that either. That'd be a good question for John, possibly.
I'm done now.
All right. Thank you so much. Go ahead, Michael. You're the last.
Okay. I believe, again, it's 1938. Up until then, federal judges were not taxed on their wages. Then they made an agreement to be taxed on their wages, and they got to, for every case that came before them, them and the prosecutor could then substantially take a portion of the fines levied against the person, any monetary value at all, and I'll guarantee you under the code, which we'll go back to Title 26, unless otherwise noted, the it states that only the excess is taxable, not the wages. So if they're not recording the excess, they're all committing crime.
Interesting.
Every judge and every prosecutor is a criminal.
That's a rather interesting topic.
Yeah, would you send me an email on that, Michael, and I'll forward it to John, whatever research you have associated with it.
All right, it'll be a couple days. Right now, I just left out of Albuquerque, and I'm driving steady. So it'll take me a couple days to get to Florida. But I'll try to get that together for you as soon as I get there.
That's appreciated. Thank you so very much. I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. Especially, I want to thank Johnny Ringo. Johnny's got 2 weeks now to prepare for his first tranche of several of many to come forward from this, where he's going to focus in detail on this first half hour or so of what he's got to say. Until then, I want to thank everybody. Remind you, tomorrow night is our new information provider. Hair Slevin is what he likes to be called, and he offers a turnkey LLC package for any business or for any employee. And if you're an employee, if you work for somebody, you need to be on this call. If you're an entrepreneur, you need to be on this call. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.